Hello, welcome to yet another episode of The Zeitgeist Tapes, in which me, Stephen Fielding, and Emma Burnell discuss whatever we want to discuss about popular culture and how it represents politics. And today, for reasons that we may decide to explain to our loyal listener, we want to talk about Party Animals. Now, Party Animals is a series that the BBC produced and broadcast at the start of 2007, so just over 11 years ago, at 9 o'clock on BBC Two. Ran for 8 weeks, and I suspect that none of you listening to this broadcast have ever heard of it. There may be one or two of you, dim and distant memories, but it hasn't really made very much of an impact. So why on earth are Emma and myself talking about a series that most people probably don't remember or didn't even know about in the first place? Well, I think, and Emma can disagree, I think that it's because it actually tries to depict politics in an accessible and a positive way. And that makes it extremely unusual, certainly in the British context. If you think about 2007 and what was going on in 2007 or 2006 when the series was being produced, it's almost like another country in many ways. It's Tony Blair's coming towards the end of his time as Prime Minister. The Conservatives are renewing themselves under David Cameron. They've taken a slight lead over Labour, one which gets bigger and bigger as the year progresses. But we're also living before the great financial crash. It's a rather different world, a world of possibilities, a world in which everybody is a progressive. Certainly, the Conservative leadership is defining itself as progressives. The Labour leadership is defining itself as centre-left progressives that are working within capitalism, but trying to achieve a fairer society. It's a very, very different world, but it's also a world in which, in the wake of the 2001 general election, fewer and fewer people are voting. And this is possibly one of the reasons why Party Animals was produced by the BBC, because it's quite deliberately trying to appeal to a younger audience and talking to them about politics. What do you think, Emma?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one of the things that struck me re-watching it was how incredibly dated it felt. It's of a very particular moment, that time between 2005 and 2008, when the Tories were sticking to Labour spending plans and, you know, very much trying to wear the mantle of heir to Blair, pre-crash, pre-austerity, you know, very, very different type of Tory party than the one we actually got in government. Now, you can argue whether that was circumstantial or what they planned all along. But I think that there aren't that many Tories who would recognise now that James, the Tory MP who's going places and clearly wants to be leader and is in many ways David Cameron, would be the leader that the Tory party would go for now, which would be about the time that James could probably expect to have become leader.
Yes. I mean, I think we probably should, for the many listeners, all three of them, who have not heard of Party Animals, we should sort of point out Party Animals. We should sort of maybe just introduce some of the characters. I mean, it is scrupulously gender balanced. It focuses on party researchers working for two MPs. One is Joe Porter, who's a female Labour junior Home Office minister. And working in her office is Danny and Kirsty. And her opposite number, James Northcote, that Emma mentioned, is a reforming, modernising Tory who's our opposite number. And he also has his own office with Ashika. And Matt, Ashika is from an Asian family, and Matt is gay. So we've got a scrupulously diverse, gender-balanced kind of setup.
Yeah.
And Danny is...
And Danny is Northern.
Danny's Northern, although actually middle class.
As is Kirsty, I believe.
Kirsty's got a northeastern accent, but clearly they're from maybe middle-class families. Danny's father had been an MP.
Danny's father was a working-class MP, and therefore Danny was middle-class.
Yes, and his mother is also a journalist, so that kind of confirms that. Danny has also got a brother, Scott, who is a lobbyist, but has also got a political conscience. He's a lobbyist with a heart, essentially. And including in that mix is also Sophie, who's a journalist. And all of them, apart from the two MPs, they're all in their kind of middle 20s, very early 30s. And the production company that made Party Animals also made This Life. And there have been some comparisons.
Oh, doesn't it show?
Comparisons, yes, between This Life, which again, maybe we may have to mention what This Life was, which was also about young 20-somethings in London trying to make it in the professions, essentially.
As lawyers.
Yeah, so that's the setup.
This Life was all based around law. It was housemates. The premise was they all lived together in this big house and they all went off to be lawyers and barristers and law clerks, yeah, etc. But actually what they did was take a lot of drugs and have a lot of sex.
And there is quite a lot of drugs taking and sex doing in Party Animals too, to be fair.
Yes, and I mean, maybe I'm just really square and boring, but the amount of gack flying around, it's like, I'm not saying I've never, ever seen it, but it's just, it was a little too much This Life and not enough This Parliament.
For our older listener, you might want to explain what gack is.
Oh, yes. Cocaine, sorry.
I've never heard it called that. So anyway, yeah, there is an incredible amount of cocaine being sniffed and a relatively large amount of sex. And that possibly gives away the audience to whom that this series is trying to appeal. And I think that's what makes it partly of interest, partly because, as Emma said, it's almost a historical curiosity, but also what it's trying to do and for whom. Because although we've mentioned the sex and the drugs, there isn't any rock and roll, but it's quite a good soundtrack, actually, that they use.
Yes, one of the things I noticed, which I thought was a really well-observed detail, was that the young lefty boys were really, really into Bruce Springsteen. Bruce Springsteen is a central part of their identity. They call each other Wendy as a reference to... oh, God, I'm losing my cred now.
I've got no clue here. We're sorry.
Sorry, Born to Run. Wendy is the girl in Born to Run. And that's why they call each other Wendy. And that really is very, very realistic to a certain type of young lefty bloke. You know, the working class, importantly, American working class authenticity of Bruce Springsteen is, you know, absolutely central to their identity in that way. And I thought that was quite a well-observed little detail.
Which passed me by because I thought, why are they talking about Peter Pan? So obviously that I'm not a Bruce Springsteen fan, so writers, be careful when you're having these clever references. Not all your audience is going to pick up on it and get completely the wrong idea about what you're trying to do.
There were two things they did that I thought were very good about that kind of having slightly off-camera details that spoke to character. And that was one. And the other one I thought was even more important was the centrality of the ANC to a certain type of, so the African National Congress Party to a certain generation of Labour people.
Yes, because Scott and Danny make reference to the fact that their parents, and obviously we've said that their father was an MP that was elected in the 1980s, that they remembered attending, you know, gatherings in their own home where members of the ANC were present. Yeah.
And one of the things that Jo does when she's cross with Danny, she punishes him by withdrawing an invitation to the South Africa to go with her to the South African embassy and meet these members of the ANC that he's looked up to his whole life. I thought that was a well observed detail that kind of just without having to do a really broad stroke, just said, yeah, this is central to this person's character. This is who they are. You've met people like this. Therefore, you don't have to know more than that to know who they are.
So the series is basically set in Portcullis House. It's the Westminster bubble, and you would think that these days it would be a setup for showing how distant these people are, how cynical they are, how they don't really care about real people outside of Westminster, how politics is just a game, and in fact that isn't how Party Animals sets it up. There is a game that's going on within. Certainly the Conservative Party, the modernizers and the traditionalists are at each other's throats. Within the Labour Party, there is a kind of an attempted coup that's neither Blairite nor Brownite. So divisions in that party are exposed, and Jo, the MP, is kind of hung out to dry when she accidentally blabs about the attempted coup. But while politics is like shown is not necessarily full of idealism all the time, virtually every participant, every character is shown to have at least some interest in ideals, in actually doing things. And maybe they have to be crafty about doing things, but they are actually interested in achieving stuff. Scott, who's the lobbyist, he decides really essentially that lobbying isn't for him. He wants to really be properly involved in politics and to change things. Danny, his brother, who is the arch idealist, always wants, you know, to do the right thing all the time. But even Jo, who you might expect being a junior Home Office minister in a new Labour government, might be on the more cynical part of the spectrum. Even she is trying to achieve some positive things in terms of young offenders, rehabilitation, and actually finds herself in a bit of a dark place for a certain period of time as a consequence of that. So everybody is being a progressive, I think, and trying within the limits of party competition and the Westminster system is trying to do their best. So in some ways, the series is trying to almost sell the Westminster system to this younger audience and try to say that people like you, they're trying to do their best in all of this. It's not all full of fat middle-aged men, although there are some fat middle-aged men in the series who are just interested in themselves. It's actually a place where you might be able to achieve positive change. And I think that's quite deliberate for the time, but I think it's interesting, like I said at the start, because this doesn't really happen very often in British drama.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, I think it's interesting that it only lasted one series, even though it quite clearly was hoping to get a second, because it ends on a romantic cliff edge. Yeah, there's a lot of scope for what could have happened next.
Yeah, that was clearly meant to be a cliffhanger for the next season, which never happened.
Somebody on our Facebook page quite interestingly pointed out that in the same way that 30 Rock killed Studio 60 by just being a bit sharper, a bit shorter and funnier and more cynical about this thing that in many ways Studio 60 took late night comedy shows way too seriously. It was Aaron Sorkin making a program about Saturday Night Live as if it were the West Wing. In many ways, the thick of it did the same for Party Animals. The thick of it just felt more in tune with how people felt about politics. And, you know, shortly after this went out, you had the expenses scandal. And I just don't think it would have been possible to make something under those at that time that was this nice and open and human. Sadly, because, you know, I think it's... there are unrealistic things about Party Animals, but actually that sense that these are people trying to do their best from whatever angle is vastly missing from our discussion of politics most of the time. The job it tries to do is a very good job. Sometimes it hits the mark, sometimes it doesn't. But you know, it's a real shame that cynicism won there.
Yes, that's a very good point about the thick of it, actually. And the thing about Party Animals, although it was on BBC Two, 9 o'clock, I think, Mondays, it really didn't attract the audience, which is why it wasn't recommissioned.
No, and they made such a splash about it, but yeah, it just didn't take
it's,
off.
It's filmed really well. It looks, you know, relatively high production values. They haven't got any A-list stars, although one or two of them become A-list stars.
Well, they are now,
but they weren't A-list at the time. But nonetheless, no. they gave it a good shot and only got apparently about 1 million viewers tops, which says something.
It's not good for that.
No, it says something interesting that people, I mean, because this wasn't a bad drama. I quite liked it. There were funny bits. There were some genuinely funny bits. And some of the characters, they're not all goody-goody two-shoes like Danny. Kirsty, his oppo in Joe's office, she's clearly a careerist. And, you know, her complete inability, her ignorance about Nelson Mandela and everything is hilarious at times. And she's played really, really well by Angela Risborough.
Andrea.
And she's a great character. So they're not all goody two shoes, and it's done very well. And the on off romance between the Labour inclined lobbyist Scott and the Tory Hindu from a working class background, I think that's done quite well. Who also, by the way, she's conducting an affair with her boss, James Northcott, the married, modernising Conservative MP. So there's lots of intrigue that's going on.
And let's just listen to a little bit of that now.
Insomnia is horrible.
So what keeps you awake at night?
Well, you know, the usual suspects. Bank, bills, family, love life, work.
What's wrong with your love life?
Mainly work, really. Getting something really badly wrong.
But you don't seem the type for that. Come work for us, we know how to look after you properly.
No offence, Scott, but I couldn't be a lobbyist. No, I want to stay in politics, maybe get a winnable constituency sometime.
I am in politics. Access is what it's all about these days.
There's only so many expense account lunches you can get excited about.
Yeah, at least in my worries.
And I think it's really well done, but for some reason, and I've no idea what was on ITV at that time. I don't know what the competition was. But it does suggest that, you know, when a positive perspective on politics is well done, people still don't want it. They just don't like it.
Yeah. No, I just think it doesn't speak to enough of our prejudices about politics. And those are so ingrained now, I think. Yeah. And I think particularly if you try to make this now, with the sympathetic portrayal of the Tories as quite sweet and nice and not that evil, and the kind of I say it was of its time, that the Labour Party are tired. What Joe really embodies in that drama, her drinking too much, her cynicism at times, her just constant knackeredness.
She does always look tired, yes.
She is embodying where the Labour Party had got to by that point in government. You know, they were tired. They were out of steam. They'd come to the end of their road. And the Tories did seem young and thrusting and like they'd changed. Although there are some very interesting scenes where it was made not explicit, but quite clear if you knew what to look for, that there was a sense in that drama that the Tory change was only skin deep. For example, when Ashika is in a pub with a bunch of other Tory researchers and, you know, the second they're drunk, the mask slips and they're saying all sorts of dreadful things to her. So Ashika may believe it, Matt may believe it, but not everybody of whatever age, because it's the point is that these are young people, they're not the old guard. The Tories haven't changed that much.
Yes, and I think that was also interesting, because if it was done today, I think there would have been more reference to misogyny, more reference to sexual abuse, because
look at the way Kirsty is treated.
Kirsty's treated very badly because she's but by another kind of researcher, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean Kirsty is basically basically led to believe if she has sex with this researcher, she will get a job. She makes the choice to have the sex, and we judge her, not him. We are very much led to judge her in the drama, and she doesn't get the job. So not only does she give the job, she doesn't get the job.
I would. Well, that's true. I would, though, disagree that we are meant to think of her in a worse light than the person who led her to believe she'd get the job if she went to bed with him. I think we're meant to think he is a total and utter sleazeball.
I think we're supposed to think he's a bit of a sleazeball, but not really care all that much. Whereas with Kirsty, we're absolutely supposed to see this as her comeuppance for not fancying Danny.
Well, I came to like Kirsty more and more, partly because there really wasn't much of a villain really in this series, which might have been a fault actually. And she was she was kind of growing on me, even though she was deeply cynical. But she was kind of learning. She seemed to be learning a little bit. So I felt she let herself down when she did that. I didn't condemn her, and I didn't really see it as a comeuppance, to be honest.
I felt they were teaching her a moral lessons, but maybe I'm being overly sensitive. Right.
But there isn't. Apart from that, although there is James Northcote, the married MP who's having an affair with the Sheikah, his researcher. That's not a coercive relationship. There are some awkward moments when a Sheikah decides she wants to become her own person, and she stands in a by-election, and he clearly gets the hump a little bit, but he ends up actually saying that he wants to marry her. So this is not shown to be a sleazy affair. This is shown to be something that he genuinely appears, you know, is forced in the end to think, well, this is actually what I want, and I will leave my wife for that. So there's no sleaze.
Although, of course, when she turns him down, he goes running back to the wife.
Of course. No, of course. And that does go back to your point about how the Tories are depicted in this series. Because there is, like you said, you know, there is a suggestion that they have remade themselves a little bit at some level. But beneath it, you know, with the traditionalist Tory, it's George, isn't it? It's mostly his. Yeah. His people who are coming out with the misogyny and the anti-gay comments when they've had a drink, but even James Northcote, there's some suggestion that, you know, he's just this plausible, you know, BS merchant, and he's doing what he has to do in order to get on. But does he really mean all this? Well, he's having an affair with an Asian researcher, and he wants to marry her, so maybe he does. But I think there is definitely some ambiguity about the depth of the conservative modernization process in 2007.
Yeah, and I think, to be fair, given what we had in conservative government from 2010 onwards, that cynicism might have been well rewarded.
That's true. No, that's also true. But some of the issues that this series does deal with, I mean, it isn't just the ins and the outs and the romantic affairs of people in the bubble. As sort of politics, 2007 politics does intrude. Like there's the issue about the Muslim. The Muslim community leader in Joe's own constituency, who is sort of exploiting, or is seen to be exploiting, the irate response of local Muslims to a film version of a novel which is seen to attack Muslims. That's something. And also, a mosque is being built in the constituency where the by-election, which takes up most of the last few episodes, is being held, and what candidates, what their position is. And the BNP is mentioned. The BNP's incursion into traditional Labour votes on this issue is mentioned, but it's never depicted. It's kind of on the horizon, really. And also the social conservatism of people in this constituency, because I should have mentioned, the by-election which Ashika stands in, and Scott, who by this point has established a romantic interest in Ashika, Scott basically leads the Labour campaign, even though he's not standing. They are, you know, they have this romantic kind of entanglement, and yet they're on different sides of the party divide.
Yes, it's very Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, and also a bit of a cliche, because, you know, by-elections ever since Charles Dickens have been used as a dramatic device, but nonetheless, it's kind of a classic trope, and it's done okay.
Yeah.
When they go to this constituency, Scott's father's constituency, it's a northern small town. It's out. It's it. They're not social conservatives. They're not social liberals in that town, are they? So so it does highlight, but it doesn't really ram it home so much, the division between those who are working in the Westminster bubble and those that they hope to represent.
Yeah, and I think the agent, the Tory agent, and the Labour candidate in the constituency kind of really quite well represent, better than the sort of mushy middle of Scott and Ashika, what the divisions in that constituency truly are. And I think that's depicted. Neither of them are depicted unsympathetically. Possibly the Labour candidate's more unsympathetic, certainly at first, because he plays into that social conservatism, asks the seeker if she's a Muslim in a quite sort of cack-handed way. Whereas the WI woman, she's blatantly a WI woman, who is the Tory agent, is, you know, that clucky mum type that we know so well from that stereotype. But in the end, both of them come across reasonably sympathetically. You understand the desperation of the Labour candidate not to let this seat that he's lived in and cared about his whole life go to the Tories, and why that's led to him behaving so badly. You understand that the reservations that the agent had about Ashika's suitableness were actually reasonable, given that she was actually shagging her boss, and that came out during the by-election. And Ashika tries to battle being a classic Tory candidate, as well as trying to battle being pigeonholed as the Muslim candidate. And you're sort of, well, I get all the things you don't want to be, Ashika, but what are you? So I felt that there were some quite interesting divisions that came that were well played through the by-election. And as you say, it is a bit of an overworn trope, but then I can't see how else they would have done that. I think it was the best way to take it out of Westminster.
No, I agree. It's just very interesting. It's whenever dramatists want to do this kind of thing, they always end up having a by-election and having a kind of romantic, romantic kind of thing going on either side. So it's a minor point. But I wondered also, maybe thinking about whether, you know, we've kind of explained to some extent why the series didn't really get a popular response. But I wondered how it could be done now, because they're very reasonable people. I mean, they have commitments. They clearly, you know, identify with a certain cause, but it doesn't mean that they can't see the other side, at least some of them can't see some on the other side, as being reasonable people. I mean, Scott and Ashika have an affair, and it looks like it's going to go the distance, but we don't know because we never get season two. But Scott's got his ideals, Ashika's got her ideals, and yet they can actually have a human relationship and at various points show genuine emotion and not just have sex. So I don't know that we could now, you know, today, I mean, Labour people are meant to hate Tories, and Tories are meant to hate Labour people. And, you know, it's Jacob Rees-Mogg versus Momentum. And there is no middle ground between these organisations that you couldn't have this reasonable depiction of, well, they have their differences, but they're all kind of trying to work from the same page.
Yeah, and I think in some ways that is exactly what current politics has rebelled against. This sense that everybody was too much on the same page, and that actually ideology had been missing from politics for too long. So I think if you were to make Party Animals 2018, crumbs, you would have to have a bit more ideology in there, and they'd have to actually talk about what their differences were. That's not to say people can't get along across the ideological divides, but I think where it went wrong was to get rid of the ideology rather than say, despite our ideology, which we clearly lay out here, on which we clearly differ, we can still get along.
Yes, I guess it's a question of emphasis, because the series isn't saying they're all the same. It's saying they are different. They have different ideas. They are in a competition to some extent. It's a silly competition of up and down and this and that. But they are all doing different versions of trying their best. And yeah, I think that's something that wouldn't be possible because of that. At least the emphasis would be they're not all trying to do their best, or that their ideas are so different. But I don't know. I mean, I really liked it. It's been a while since I last saw it, but I think, and I don't want to sound nostalgic.
It's really engaging.
It's very well done. It really is, listener. It's very well done.
Yeah.
And it's not being nostalgic.
And what a cast. I mean, let's just go through. We've got Doctor Who, Andrea Risbah, who is in everything, including Margaret Thatcher, future Margaret Thatcher, future ex-Margaret Thatcher. you've got Scott ends up in Broadchurch. James Northcote was the boss in The Office. I've seen Joe in 100 other things. I mean, it's quite an extraordinary cast.
Yeah, it's a really good cast with some very good writing. And I think, you know, some people who have, you know, lived that life would probably go, no, it's not. It wasn't really like that. But that's they always say that. But
there were two things. I'm just going to point them out for our Westminster-based audience, which I suspect is at least two of our three listeners. Two things that got me that I just thought, oh, no. Joe is on Newsnight, and then there's this sense that they should all go to the pub afterwards. I'm like, what time do you think Newsnight is on? And so that's a tiny, silly little thing. Even sillier was the dramatic incident that ended the first episode, in which somebody is run down outside the Westminster Arms. Now, again, this is the most parochial village point that I could possibly make. But the idea that anyone could drive a car fast enough past the Westminster Arms to even bruise somebody is slightly bizarre. It's on this tiny, cobbled, cut-off street that is impossible to drive down at more than 10 miles an hour.
These are details lost on the great provincial audience, which, well, that's...
Indeed. Yeah. Anyone watching that outside of the Westminster bubble or anyone listening to me now has just... I have exposed myself as problematic bubble fodder.
So I think, in conclusion, and Emma, you have your own take on this, but I think it's a series which, if you want to be nostalgic for a time when politics wasn't quite as nasty as it is today, then I would certainly recommend it. But I would also recommend it because it might show you that politics doesn't always have to be like it is today. You can have a politics where people can disagree and not hate each other's guts.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of its problem, at least dramatically, is it relied too much on sex and drugs and rock and roll type drama rather than political drama. There was a lot of intrigue and not enough ideology to actually make it a political drama rather than just a drama around politics. But it's perfectly good at that. This life, people know what they're doing when it comes to that. It's a very interesting... I would say that anyone who's interested in what it's like to work in Westminster, it's not a bad little primer. Some of the office life is quite painfully true to life in terms of its depictions. The desperately difficult interpersonal relationships between MPs and their staff, the way that the MPs treat their staff, both good and bad, the symbiotic relationship that Danny and Joe have in particular is so true to life in terms of how MPs and their researchers exist together. And you live and die by your MP, and an MP lives and dies by their researcher. And so, of course, that becomes a very unhealthy relationship many, many times. So I think it's absolutely a good thing to watch if what you're interested in doing is going off and becoming either an MP or an MP's researcher. Because I do think it was a positive about working in and being in politics, but a warts and all positive.
Yes, a reasonable, dramatic account of politics at a certain point. So it just leaves me. I now have to do the obligatory request for you to anyone listening to this, if you would be so kind as to rate and review this podcast on iTunes, and to remind everybody, all three of our listeners, I think we've gone up from one to three, that this is a political human production.